Mr. Soucy, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Jerry Soucy. I'm entered a limited appearance in this case to argue this on behalf of Mr. Robinson, who has, prior to these proceedings, been moving pro se. It's no secret that I consider post-conviction to be one of the most important elements in the criminal justice system. I view that as a quality control mechanism by which the courts can review what has happened in the cases below. And it pains me when that process it gets passed off to pro se inmates to try and do the best they can in terms of presenting their issues, and somehow it may not be as precise and necessary, or precise and clear as it should be. I would prefer that they leave the law library and just write the factual story of what happened, and then I think that would be a much easier and better way that this system would work. And the other problem is that in post-conviction area, most of the rules regarding pleadings and how you proceed are court-made rules and not set forth in the rules of procedure, and you have to be smart enough.
So you're just saying as long as somebody gets something timely filed, then when he gets appointed counsel, then counsel can move for leave to amend.
Absolutely.
And then correct all of the errors and defects made by the conduct.
Absolutely, and that's what really needs to happen. That having been said, I appreciate the brief that the Attorney General's office did, because I think they actually did a pretty good job of sort of summarizing the facts. And this is a first. You may not see me do that very often, but I think they did a pretty good job. I do not agree with their conclusions, but I think they give you a pretty good roadmap of what transpired. And there are a lot of unusual things in this case. At this point, Mr. Robinson is alleging essentially three, possibly four, issues regarding the ability to amend. And number one, I think you need to remember that regards to the allegation of defense of others. The law is that when you present any evidence involving defense of others, you don't have to prove it. You simply have to present some evidence. And there is absolutely no doubt in this record that there was evidence of defense of others. He was entitled to that instruction. No doubt about it. In fact, the Court of Appeals agreed with that. The Court of Appeals says, yeah, you're right. It was error not to give the instruction on defense of others. However, what happened then is that the Court of Appeals said, but it's not prejudicial. And I think that that's absolutely incorrect. So what Mr. Robinson did in his post-conviction action is he alleged that while my appellant counsel may have won the battle, he lost the war by not alleging the prejudice associated with not getting the instruction on defense of others. Having fallen into that own trap myself on one occasion, I do that now, where I have a situation where the Attorney General's office does not argue it's not prejudicial. It ends up being raised sui sponte by the court, and I can end up win the battle that the error took place, but I don't get the reversal that I believe my client is entitled to for that error of law. In regards to the second issue regarding the appeal not to or the motion to discharge, again, that issue was before the Court of Appeals, but the Court of Appeals turned the appeal of the motion to continue into the failure to appeal the motion for discharge, which was correctly filed a day or two before the trial actually started. And that was not appealed. And I would submit that every defense lawyer knows or should know that when you have a motion to dismiss for a statutory violation of the speedy trial, that jurisdictionally you must raise it at that time. You cannot, even by agreement of counsel with the prosecution, say, okay, I filed this motion, we're going to do it later. I believe that's State versus Trevino. And that's been around for 20, 30 years. And so, as a matter of law, the question becomes, was his lawyer ineffective for not appealing that instantaneously or the same day? And I think the answer to that has to be yes. Every competent lawyer knows that. And a lot of incompetent lawyers know that.
Well, to get to that, to say that it was deficient, though, there had to be merit.
That's the second part of the issue. That's correct. Right. I agree with that.
Would it be deficient, and then you go on to, was it prejudicial, which would mean was it meritorious had it been done, right?
It would have been meritorious. And that then turns on the facts associated with the government's motion to continue. And Mr. Robertson correctly identifies as, wait a minute, this is based on a pregnancy, childbirth, that took place, I believe, in October, although we don't have the date in the record of when the child was born. But the prosecution was represented by two lawyers, both Ms. Shear, who was pregnant, and Mr. Cousy, who was not. And Mr. Cousy made all of those appearances. And the question becomes, well, Mr. Cousy, what's the problem with you doing the trial? Since you've been attorney of record since the information was filed. And so that issue should have been raised and litigated. And that, it's not a frivolous issue. It's, you know, a pregnancy.
Counsel, did the trial court find there was good cause for the requested continuance?
It did, but I'm saying is that the evidence presented to the trial court was not sufficient. And that issue was never decided. It wasn't decided by the Court of Appeal. All the records show, the trial court made a finding that there was good cause shown. It doesn't mean that finding of good cause shown was correct.
If an appeal had been taken, wouldn't that finding have been reviewed for abuse of discretion?
I would not have brought it up that way. I would have brought it up in the means that pregnancy in and of itself is not, as a matter of law, sufficient. I would have brought it up as a matter of law. I don't think it's a discretionary matter on the part of a trial court to find that pregnancy is unavoidable inadvertence or whatever. I think as a matter of law, pregnancy is no different than saying I'm having selective knee surgery in 6 months. Therefore, when it comes up to that 6 months, I say, oh, wait a minute, I want to have a continuance because I'm having knee surgery. I don't think
you can put off knee surgery. It's harder to put off a birth.
But
you'd agree with that.
But you know you're pregnant for at least 8 months. So it's not, my point is not the procedure. My point is that the knowledge that you're going to have that procedure in the future requires you to make certain plans. In this particular case, I'm sure Mrs. Shearer had made plans for other cases. She had made plans for everything else. But she's not the problem. The problem was Mr. Cousy. Mr. Cousy was there. He had been attorney all along. It happens all the time. I'm co-counsel with a case, and all of a sudden on the eve of trial, co-counsel has to go do something else. I pick up somebody. Lastly, I want to talk about the jury misconduct issue. That requires an evidentiary hearing because there is no evidence in this record that Mr. Robinson agreed to what happened or how it was represented to him. That juror, just like in the Robert Trammell case, had discussed what he saw when he went to the scene. And that's extremely important. What happened was not just a juror did something wrong. It is that juror went back and contaminated the jury. He contaminated the jury in regards to facts that went exactly to the situation involving the instruction defense of others. Where was he at? Where was the shooting? And so forth. And for that reason, this should be remanded for an evidentiary hearing on that issue, because the record is not sufficient. It is not correct on what took place in that regard. I want to save some time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Ralph, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is
Austin Relf. I represent the state of Nebraska. I'll just jump straight into the alleged ineffective assistance of counsel claims in the post-conviction motion. The first one was the alleged ineffective assistance regarding failure to prove prejudice on the lack of defense of others jury instruction. I think this court has stated most recently in State v. Nolan, the failure necessarily to persuade the appellate court does not equate to deficient performance. He raised the issue, he asked for a mistrial, asserted that it was prejudicial. The Court of Appeals found otherwise, correctly in our view. He then PFR'd on that issue. This court denied that PFR. Appellate counsel did basically everything he needed to or required to. His performance was not deficient on that issue. So we submit that that claim was properly denied without an evidentiary hearing. The second claim was that his appellate counsel was ineffective for not raising his trial counsel's ineffectiveness for not appealing the denial of the motion to discharge. And, of course, you know, it's a layered ineffectiveness claim. As I said in my brief, I think it turns on whether the motion to discharge had merit. As I set forth in there, you know, the information is filed May 19th, 2010. You add in excludable periods for the motion to continue as well as the motion for depositions. And he was tried almost a month before he needed to be. He was required to be brought to trial May 16th, 2011. He was brought to trial April of that year. As far as the motion to continue, counsel said that, you know, he's represented by two lawyers, you know, the whole time, Mr. Cusa and Ms. Shearer. That's not how I read the record. In the appellant's brief, he asserted that Mr. Cusa was there from the beginning, and he cited to transcript pages 9 and 10. Those are simply him signing for Mrs. Shearer on pleading in the district court.
Are you saying that the record clearly shows that he had no speedy trial claim?
Yes. So Mr. Cusa was not an attorney from the beginning, based on those pages, as well as his affidavit that he submitted to the trial court.
So, Mr. Susi argues for sort of a bright line rule that pregnancy cannot be good cause, can never be good cause. What's your response to that?
That's wrong. In fact, the Court of Appeals case that Mr. Robertson cited in his brief explicitly said, you know, pregnancy can be good cause. It's just that at some point, the criminal defendant's right to have a speedy trial would trump that. But it, you know, it didn't say pregnancy by itself could not be good cause, and I submit that it is a valid reason. Along with, he also submitted in his affidavit, look, you know, this is a complicated case. There's lots of, you know, witnesses to prepare. There's 400 pages of police reports. And that was another basis for the trial court granting the motion to continue. And I also submit that when you look at the record, the trial court was skeptical from the beginning. He says, look.
Well, if the motion to continue takes the trial outside the time for a speedy trial, hasn't the defendant waived that issue?
Well, it was the prosecutor's motion to continue.
It wasn't chargeable against the defendant.
Right. It was added in as excludable time based on the subsections related to the prosecutor's motion for the continuance or for.
But again, the record shows that he was tried within the time required.
Yes.
Okay.
And the district court, when addressing the motion to continue, says, look, you know, I don't normally give prosecutors a continuance, but in this particular case, based on the circumstances, based on the absence of Ms. Shearer due to pregnancy, he found that was sufficient and granted the motion to continue. It was not an abuse of discretion, which Your Honor brought up to be.
Can you remind me what's the state of the record with respect to a co-counsel or the availability of a substitute counsel for the state?
Yeah, the record, I think, his assertion in his brief was Mr. Cusa was there from the beginning, and he cited to pages 9 and 10 of the transcript. Well, the transcript, those pages are simply Mr. Cusa signing a document for Mrs. Shearer. And in his affidavit, he explains that, you know, and the record, I think, at the hearing shows that he's new to the case. He can't prepare in time, and that's why he needed the continuance.
Are there other appearances throughout the pendency of the case?
There was nothing by Mr. Cusa that I'm aware of in the record outside of at that motion to continue. And to be fair, it's been a while since I've read the Bill of Exceptions, but when reviewing my notes, there's nothing in there about him appearing.
I guess where I'm going is like, you know, the docket sheet and they show up periodically and so-and-so appears and
no, it was
time
always
marches
Ms.
on.
It was always Ms. Shearer appearing.
And only. And she's the
yes.
only one that appeared during the pendency of it. Is that
I what believe the record so, yes. Until, again, Mr. Cusa came on for the motion to continue. And then at trial, they both were there. Presumably, she came back from the pregnancy, and rather than...
And the state's position is this is so complex that she's the only one that can do it?
Well, I mean, it was a complicated trial. At the time, it was, eight counts, four counts of attempted second-degree murder, four counts of use. There were a lot of witnesses. There were a lot of police reports. There was, forensic firearm analysis. So it was a complicated case, and I believe in the record it also shows that he was having trouble getting the witnesses, and there was a lot to deal with. So, yes, I don't think that there was an abuse of discretion in the court granting the motion to continue. As such, it would be properly excludable, and the record affirmatively refutes that claim. Third claim on the juror misconduct, he alleged ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to move for a mistrial, or ineffective appellate assistance of counsel for not raising trial counsel's ineffectiveness for not moving for mistrial. And opposing counsel said that, there's nothing in the record about Mr. Robertson agreeing to that, but on pages 629 to 630, Robertson's counsel made a record that he had discussed moving for a mistrial with Robertson, but that Robertson had agreed to proceed with the current jury. Now,
The court then talk with Mr. Robertson about that? Is there anything in the record that you can look at and say Mr. Robertson agreed with that decision?
I don't want to state for certain on that. I believe he also posed the question to Mr. Robertson, and Robertson agreed that that's what they had, the conclusion they'd come to. What the Court of Appeals said was, well, the record's not sufficient because we don't know the substance of that conversation between him and his counsel, what kind of reasons, what kind of advice he gave.
Would that warrant a hearing?
Well, they said it did. I perhaps would question that. It would seem when you look at the juror misconduct, and he says, I visited the scene, but it didn't change anything. It wasn't relevant to the evidence. I didn't talk to the other jurors. And then they remove him and place the alternate juror. It seems to me that there's a no prejudice argument there, regardless whether the motion of mistrial had been filed. But the Court of Appeals said the record's insufficient, so arguably had he then said in his post-conviction motion, trial counsel is ineffective.
Well, did the substitute juror then deliberate with the jury?
Yes, they restarted the deliberations and with the alternate juror and found him guilty. But the point I wanted to make was that because the Court of Appeals found the record insufficient, if he had properly alleged that claim in his post-conviction motion, trial counsel is ineffective for not moving for a mistrial, the district court, I think, based on this court's decision in Seeberger, we would have had to give him an evidentiary hearing, but he didn't. His claim was that his appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to petition for further review, and as we all know, there is no requirement, there is no right to counsel on a petition for further review, so he was not deficient in not doing that. So his claim is out, and that is that. As far as the remaining claims, they weren't really argued today, and I'll submit those on the brief unless this court has any questions for me on that. Thank you. We ask you to affirm the judgment in all respects.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 45 seconds? 45 seconds, Mr. Soucy.
Thank you. Justice Stacy, I don't want to overstate that I'm talking about a bright line rule. What I'm saying is that pregnancy is like elective surgery and that you know it's going to happen at some future date. When you know that there's going to be an event coming up in the future that will affect your ability to try the case, I believe Ms. Shearer, Mr. Cousy had the obligation back in September, August, what have you, to make plans for that future event, that you cannot wait for that event to come down and then say, oh, wait a minute, I can't try this case because I'm having a
So what did the judge actually say or do there? Did the judge, what does the record show? Was the judge, in fact, skeptical? And
he was sort of skeptical, but the problem is you don't have that record in front of you. This court hasn't had it because the lawyer did not appeal the motion to discharge. He could not have, he had to appeal the motion to discharge. The Court of Appeals is correct. The denial of the motion to continue doesn't make it. What makes it has to be the failure to dismiss. And then when you appeal a failure to dismiss interlocutorily, then the court has before it the merits of the question of whether or not the motion to continue was good or bad.
And that's,
that issue's never been decided.
And that's because the defendant shouldn't have to go through an entire trial before you reach the issue of speedy trial.
Exactly, exactly. One other thing, though, in the record is that there is, I believe, nothing showing that Mr. Robertson ever said anything to the district court. It was all the representations of his counsel. So everything
with respect
that's in the
to
record.
The mistrial, the juror?
The juror mistrial.
Right.
Was
What's
he
the
present?
Law in that area?
No.
I beg your pardon?
I'm sorry.
Was he present? When
I don't believe so. I believe it was just the attorneys.
What's the law in that area?
Regarding
that. Regarding what the juror did and
the Trammell case says it's reversible. Robert Trammell, depends on which Robert Trammell case you look at. There are a number of them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next case of the day is Everts versus